Hello there and welcome. Today is Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the controversy continues over the Justice Department's injection into a criminal case of a close Trump associate.
I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody, and I said at the time, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial boards, or the president, I'm going to do what I think is right.
Firefighters in Australia are finally getting a break. Also ahead, Rolling Stones fans have a rare opportunity to take a piece of history home. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Attorney General William Barr said Thursday President Donald Trump's attacks on prosecutors, the judge and jurors, and the trial of a longtime advisor undermined the Justice Department's work, adding that he would not be bullied by anyone. In an ABC interview, Barr, the country's top law enforcement officer, spoke about his Justice Department abandoned prosecutors' initial recommendation after his Justice Department to give the veteran Republican operative 7 to 9 years in prison, prompting all four prosecutors to quit the case. Trump has weighed in on Twitter all week with comments and aroused concerns his administration is weakening the rule of law. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Attorney General William Barr tells ABC's Pierre Thomas,
I think it's time to stop the tweeting about Department of Justice criminal cases.
Barr says Trump's tweets have done real damage.
People in the department are men and women here, about cases pending in the department, and about judges before whom we have cases, make it impossible for me to do my job.
The ABC interview comes after Barr overruled his own prosecutors who recommended Trump's longtime confidant Roger Stone be sentenced to 7 to 9 years in prison, and then he took the extraordinary step of lowering the amount while not offering an amended number. Barr is scheduled to testify to Congress at the end of next month. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. The U.S. seizes shipment of Iranian-made weapons. The United States confirms a, quote, reduction in violence proposal negotiated with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Amid soaring tensions, leaders are preparing for a key global security summit. And live brain donations are helping scientists treat epilepsy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Democratic presidential candidates, hoping to revive their lagging campaigns, are increasingly taking aim at former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, blasting their billionaire rival for trying to buy his way into the White House and raising concerns about his commitment to racial equality. The sniping reflects the remarkably fluid state of the Democratic race, even after two states that typically winnow presidential fields have already voted. Joining us to discuss is Politico reporter Daniel Lipman. Daniel, it would seem the attacks against Joe Biden have now turned squarely toward Michael Bloomberg.
Joe Biden's campaign and candidacy seems to be sinking like a rock. He was supposed to be the most electable candidate to defeat Donald Trump in the eyes of many Democrats. But so far, he's had very poor showings in Iowa and New Hampshire, which he had tried very hard to compete to win or at least do very well. And seems like Nevada and South Carolina could be similar outcomes in terms of it doesn't look like he has a strong base of support and people are fleeing from his campaign.
Right. I think that because the number one issue for Democrats these days seems to be the person who can beat Donald Trump above all else. And apparently President Trump at one point thought that as well, because he was certainly going after Joe Biden. Now it seems like all the attacks are aimed at former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, including coming from everywhere, including Joe Biden.
Yeah, Trump's messaging has changed and he doesn't really care about Joe Biden anymore. Now he's attacking Michael Bloomberg on a daily, regular basis. And that's not a surprise. Trump goes after people he thinks are threats. And obviously, it doesn't look like he views Joe Biden as a threat anymore. And so I think this has been a shift in the making. And Michael Bloomberg's hundreds of millions of dollars that he's spending has definitely helped matters in terms of clarifying you know, who has the money and the resources to go the distance.
Well, he definitely has that, and I think people are for sure taking a second look at him, but also with that comes scrutiny, and of course he's under fire for a lot of his former policies, including with African Americans when he was mayor. How big of an impact will that have, or is that just the attack of the day?
I think it's going to have some impact, but I don't think it's going to be an enduring news story, because this is baked in the cake in terms of everyone knows that Michael Bloomberg was tough on crime and he had the Stop and Frisk program, which he has apologized for. But people could see it as politically convenient that he is suddenly apologizing for the stuff that he had previously held steady on.
Right, but if it were to impact the African-American vote, which is big, which Joe Biden was certainly counting on, that could have an impact. But it doesn't look like Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg, both who have been rising steadily, attention has been drawn to them, shall we say, but doesn't look like they have much African-American support either. Where are these people looking for? What are these people looking for? Where will they find a home? Will they stay with Joe Biden?
I don't think all of them are going to stay. Some of them definitely are, because Joe Biden has a good record with African Americans. He was a very loyal vice president to Barack Obama, the nation's first African American president. And so that really has helped him. But every candidate seems to have issues with minorities. You know, Bernie Sanders comes from a very white state in Vermont. Elizabeth Warren has gotten in trouble with her ethnicity because she said on forums that she was Native American. Michael Bloomberg had Stop and Frisk. Joe Biden had some issues with African Americans as well, describing Barack Obama as clean, which was a bad look for him. And so Mayor Pete has had issues with firing the first black police chief in South Bend, Indiana, and also the African American fire chief. And so there's no really perfect candidate here, and the minority candidates have mostly dropped out except for Tulsi Gabbard.
Is there any indication of how well or not well Joe Biden will do in Nevada, or is that still pretty fluid? And if he does not do well, would you say that would be pretty much the nail in the coffin for his campaign?
I think it's going to really hurt his campaign, almost like a body blow, if he doesn't do well in Nevada. But we really don't know how it's looking precisely, and so he could rally and come back. But it looks like the Democratic Party is moving on and is not relying on Joe Biden to be the nominee anymore. And so that's been a shift in the last week or so. But I think I would expect that to continue if Joe Biden doesn't come in first in South Carolina and Nevada.
All right. That's Politico reporter Daniel Lipman. Thanks for being with us. The World Health Organization says the large increase in the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in China the past day is due in part to a change in how cases are being diagnosed and reported. This comes as an additional 13,332 cases were added overnight in the Hubei province. In Japan, one of the worst affected by the epidemic outside of China, reports its first fatality from the virus. And health officials here confirm a 15th case of coronavirus in the United States. VOA correspondent Mariama Diablo has the latest.
The World Health Organization says most of the cases responsible for the spike in Hubei province are retrospectively reported and not new infections.
So this increase that you've all seen in the last 24 hours is largely in part down to a change in how cases are being diagnosed and reported.
He also says the changes allow doctors to report and treat cases more quickly. Huoshenshan Hospital, a specialized hospital built in Wuhan amid the outbreak, says it saw its first 7 cured patients on Thursday. Among them, the eldest was a 66-year-old.
People are so nice here. The nurses called me auntie. They took good care of us, body and mind, so we recovered very fast. I want to say to the people across the country, don't be afraid. We have already recovered, and all of you should have faith in winning this battle against the virus.
Meanwhile, Japan announced its first fatality from the virus hours after confirming more cases on the Diamond Princess cruise ship quarantined near Tokyo, as fears of the spreading disease mount in the country.
At this point, we do not have sufficient epidemiological information pointing to the spread of the virus in Japan. Going forward, we will collect epidemiological information, consult experts, and then consider necessary measures.
In the United States, a patient who was quarantined at an Air Force base in Texas was officially diagnosed with the disease. He had returned to the U.S. on a State Department chartered flight last week.
The individual has been quarantined since arriving at Lackland Air Force Base from the Wuhan province in China, and the individual remains in isolation in a local hospital.
It brings the total number to 15 cases in the U.S., where officials insist the risk to the public remains low. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Well, the U.S. and Taliban have negotiated a proposal for a seven-day reduction in violence. Confirmation from the Trump administration came after NATO leaders discussed the way forward in Afghanistan at a defense meeting in Brussels. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb was there with Defense Secretary Mark Esper and has this report.
Just days after an insider attack that killed two U.S. service members, Defense Secretary Mark Esper announced Thursday a U.S. Taliban proposal to curb the fighting in Afghanistan.
The United States and the Taliban have negotiated a proposal for a seven-day reduction in violence. We've said all along that the best, if not only, solution in Afghanistan is a political agreement. Progress has been made on this front, and we'll have more to report on that soon.
Esper declined to discuss further details, but seemed confident the time frame is long enough to determine whether the Taliban is serious about the deal.
It is our view that 7 days for now is sufficient, but in all things, our approach to this process will be conditions-based.
A senior defense official familiar with Afghanistan said Thursday the U.S. is watching the violence closely and has a means of determining whether the Taliban is acting in good faith. Members of the Trump administration are touting the agreement as an important breakthrough on the path to peace talks between the Taliban and Afghan government. President Trump has repeatedly said he wants to get out of forever wars, including the Afghan war. But experts caution the administration must stick to its plan for a conditions-based approach to the Taliban, or U.S. troops and their allies could face harsh consequences on the battlefield.
Well, what happens when we put our arms down in a boxing match? Unless the bell has rung, which is not ringing, we're going to get clocked. And, you know, the Taliban is not going to stop fighting just because we say, you know, we're tired, we want to go home.
Fire.
U.S. commanders and Secretary Esper have said they're comfortable cutting U.S. force numbers in Afghanistan to about 8,600. Should the reduction in violence negotiation hold, plans for a reduction of U.S. forces could soon follow. Carla Babb, VOA News, Munich.
Well, fires across Australia's most populous state of New South Wales are finally contained or altogether out for the first time in nearly 6 months after a dose of heavy rain. Australia has been battling hundreds of blazes since September in an unusually prolonged summer wildfire season, fueled by 3 years of drought, which experts have attributed to climate change. Joining us now to talk more about the situation on the ground and why this is not just a climate emergency is Professor Mark Howden, director of the Australian National University's Climate Change Institute. What's the status at this point with these bushfires?
Most of the fires have actually been put out or at least contained, and that's due to some really heavy rainfall. And so we've had a very powerful east coast low, which is like a hurricane, and that's actually dumped record rainfall in some places. And so most of those fires, which were raging just a few weeks ago, are actually now out.
Well, that is good news for sure. I know fire season isn't over yet, so there probably are still a little bit of a concern about that, but definitely a big improvement.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, that rain's largely been restricted to the coast, and the more inland areas haven't received that rain. So there's still, I think, a high fire risk in those places.
You recently gave a pretty stark warning when you gave the keynote address at the annual climate update at the Australian National University. You say that what's been happening there in Australia, these fires that have devastated communities, are not just a climate emergency, but much more serious. Tell us what you meant by that.
Yeah, so a lot of people and organizations have used the terminology of climate emergency, and I can understand that. However, I just have a little problem with the framing of that, because an emergency is defined as something which is unexpected and requiring a short-term response, whereas what we're seeing in terms of climate change is actually entirely expected. We've been predicting this for decades, and it actually requires a long-term response over decades to centuries. So in some ways, it's almost like the opposite of an emergency in that respect. And so I think we need to be framing this much more accurately as that really significant, almost systemic issue that we have to deal with over a long, long time frame.
What are you recommending be done? It certainly would appear, at least on a global level, that things are not moving in the right direction. People are, you know, we do see efforts and we do see a lot of concern, but governments don't seem to really be doing anything significant enough yet to really turn any of this around.
No, in fact, greenhouse gas emissions across the globe went up 0.6% last year, a little bit less than they did the year before, but nevertheless it went up. So we're emitting almost 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year from fossil fuels, cement manufacturing, similar things, to keep the temperature down to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial, and that's the Paris Agreement goal. We have to take that 40 billion tons a year and reduce it effectively to zero by 2050. If we're to keep to 2 degrees, we have to go to net zero by 2070. And either of those goals seems to be really difficult given the current lack of action across the globe.
And we hear a lot of talk about the catastrophic effects that we will see most likely if things aren't changed. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean?
No, I tend not to use the word catastrophic because that brings a really doom and gloom element to it, and it turns off a lot of people and disempowers a lot of people. But nevertheless, some groups are using that word, and the insurance companies starting to use that word more frequently. And so it is a big issue. And not wishing to get hung up on the language, but when we start to look at the impacts of climate change, even what sound like modest climate changes, like 1.1 degrees where we are now, or 1.5 degrees where we may be in a decade and a half, what we're actually seeing is really large-scale impact. So climate change has already impacted on global agriculture. So in Australia, our profits have dropped 22% because of the climate changes we've seen over the last 2 decades. That's a really, really big hit. If we look at sea level rise, it's gone up significantly, increasing flood risk across the globe. And some of that's happening in the US around Florida, where you see sort of sunny day flooding events. And the list can go on. So we're actually seeing really significant impacts just at 1.1 degrees. When we take it to 1.5, those really expand significantly. And even if we take it just a little half a degree more up to 2 degrees, they expand dramatically. And so we see a lot more people in danger of going hungry or not having enough water or suffering significant health risks or suffering potential migration pressure because of loss of land. And again, the list goes on. And so we're really looking down the barrel of very, very significant impacts at a global scale.
That's Mark Howden, director of the Australian National University's Climate Change Institute. Thank you for being with us. Well, 2 years after a gunman killed 17 students and wounded 17 others at a Florida high school, turning it into an international symbol of gun violence in America, the work goes on. VOA's Esha Grover and Sadiq Ul Islam talk with people whose lives are still being shaped by the attack.
You can't grasp the words sometimes. That it's a feeling. It's a feeling that I have now because of it. And it affects me almost every day. I feel like it's some sort of anxiety that gets to me. You know, I always have an escape route, or I always look at the door.
All there's incredible sadness. That's ever present. I miss my daughter very much. Everybody who lost somebody that day misses somebody.
When the numbness wears off, the realness sets in. It's like really never going to go away. You know, these people are never coming back no matter what. And so that's difficult to deal with.
2 years after the tragic high school shooting on February 14th, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School is quiet.
And I think as teachers, I think we were a little surprised at how difficult this year was. We have a different experience as teachers because all of our administration was replaced. So at the beginning of the year, we had brand new administration, and it seems insulting that it's never talked about or addressed.
As surviving students who became household names across America through their activism settle into studying at universities, some worry that their voices are fading.
They did go to the capital of Florida. They went to D.C. And I feel like they did get the certain people who listened to them to really get on their page of policy. But I don't really think they made much of a dent.
But some parents of the victims have continued lobbying the federal government for school safety. This week, advocacy group Stand With Parkland unveiled a website funded by the federal government which will help schools assess their security and take steps to better it.
Trying to work through this process to get some kind of change has helped us all greatly. Sadly, we've been given a microphone and a platform to speak from, and we're going to use it as long as people will listen to us.
Though sadness continues to be a part of the lives of all those affected, they find relief in each other's shared experiences and strength.
I'm, like, continuously impressed with the perseverance and the courage of my colleagues, because being someone that was there and knows how hard it is and that have struggled with depression and anxiety as a result of this, so I understand that they are too. Having the same struggles, and that we have just really rallied together this week.
And many in Parkland say they will continue to rally as the years after the tragedy pass. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Parkland, Florida.
And you're listening to International Edition. We will be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Valentine's Day has become one of the most popular holidays of the year that millions of people in the U.S. and even worldwide celebrate. This year, international students at several Washington, D.C. area universities shared their thoughts and plans for the most romantic day of the year. VOA's Julie Tabeau reports.
On February 14th, millions of Americans across the country will celebrate Valentine's Day. Lovers will present their beloved with cards, candies, and flowers, or celebrate in other romantic ways.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day. Love you.
International students in the D.C. area shared their own plans for the day.
This year, I'll probably have a dinner with my girlfriend, and it's pretty much the same that we celebrate in Honduras, so I'll probably just have a dinner, watch a movie, something like that.
I have a boyfriend. He is still back in the Netherlands. We have a long-distance relationship now, but he comes like once in a while. And the idea is that he actually comes back on Valentine's Day or like the day after. So we're definitely like, you know, go for like a nice dinner and stuff like that.
Since I'm single right now, so like we're just gonna go to like a restaurant and chat for a little bit. And then after that, we're probably going to karaoke or just head home and prepare our home party.
Named after St. Valentine, the patron saint of lovers, the day is celebrated the world over.
In Taiwan, in Valentine's Day, we actually give chocolate to someone that we have a crush on, or we like it, or someone we like, or maybe you are like boyfriend or girlfriend, you like each other.
And in China, on Valentine's Day, the boys give chocolates to the girls they like. And after a month, during the White Valentine's Day, the girl give back chocolate to those boys they like.
That second Valentine's Day, called White Day or White Valentine's Day, is celebrated in Japan, Taiwan, China, and other Asian countries a month later, on March 14th. But no matter which date it's celebrated, it's a sentiment behind it that makes it truly unique.
I'm single now, yeah, and my plan is to make a video for
girl I'm dating with, yeah, and to express my emotions for her. I play acoustic guitar, and she loved that, and I want to make some songs for her.
Having some nice food together, some wine, and enjoy each other's company, I think it's really nice, yeah.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
University of Copenhagen researchers have extracted a complete human genome from 5,700-year-old chewing gum. They say it's the first time an entire ancient human genome has been extracted from anything other than human bones. The chewing gum, which is actually pitch or tar extracted from a birch tree, was found during archaeological excavations in southern Denmark. The scientists say they were also able to extract DNA from oral microorganisms and key human pathogens. After analyzing the genome, the scientists found that the ancient gum chewer was a female and was more closely related genetically to people from mainland Europe than those who lived in Scandinavia at the time. The genome also revealed that she probably had dark skin, dark hair, and blue eyes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Former Rolling Stones bassist Bill Wyman says he plans to auction off some of the instruments that he used while he was in the band. Some of the other items in the more than 1,000-lot auction will include awards, concert posters, costumes, photos, and correspondence. It will all be on the auction block in Hollywood, California, Beverly Hills, I should say, between May 29th and the 31st. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com, and we thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard.
Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.